Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to this episode of the College Commons Podcast and our conversation with David B. Oppenheimer. David B. Oppenheimer is a clinical professor of law, is the co-director of the Pro Bono Program, and the director of the Berkeley Center on Comparative Equality and Anti-Discrimination Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He has taught at a number of universities, including the Sorbonne and the University of Bologna, among others, and published widely, including his most recent book, The Diversity Principle. Welcome, Professor Oppenheimer, and thank you for joining us on the College Commons Podcast.
Thank you very much, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here.
At the core of your book, you illustrate two key points about the evolution of the concept of diversity in the American civic discourse. First, you describe its history, which long predates our living memory, even though, truth be told, we tend to think of the idea as a new one. And second, you connect the dots between diversity in the service of the voiceless and disenfranchised and diversity in the service of the empowered majority. So first things first, let's break it down. And let me ask you to give us the very essential key points about what we need to know in the history of the diversity principle.
I think the first thing we need to understand is that the idea of diversity, the idea that when you bring together people with different backgrounds and different experiences and different viewpoints, they do a better job of teaching and learning. They do a better job of solving problems. Their processing of information is just better. There was a professor at Columbia whose succinct comment was, "Diversity makes us smarter." And this is at the heart of the modern research university, has been since the founding of the first modern research university, the University of Berlin, in 1810, with a decision to include Catholics and Jews as part of the university, which just never would have occurred but for the importance to the founders of the educational benefits of diversity. And second, there's been a continuing commitment to diversity at universities. That doesn't mean universities haven't discriminated against students of many sorts over much time. But nonetheless, at the heart of the research university, there's been this continuing and growing commitment to the idea that diversity in the classroom and diversity in the laboratory is good for the research work and the teaching work that a university does.
Tell us a bit about the argument for diversity as something that actually behooves the empowered or enfranchised majority.
Well, if you're empowered and enfranchised, you want to see continuing growth and success in your society. You want to see the production of greater wealth. You want to see progress. And diversity contributes to progress. Diverse businesses, that is, businesses in which there are diverse leaders, are more successful. Diversity improves democratic discourse. Science labs that have various kinds of diversity, including racial and ethnic and gender diversity, find more important discoveries. So diversity is a part of a formula for a successful society. You know, we used to think, I don't know, maybe we said it and didn't think it, that great minds think alike. And it turns out that's just completely wrong. It's when you have diverse minds, diverse points of view, different points of view, clashing and debating and trying to see each other's point that you get real brilliance.
You are, in fact, yourself a background character in the story, not merely its historian and teller, because you cast yourself as a former diversity skeptic, if I may use the term. What changed inside of you?
Well, I thought of diversity as this invention of the conservative to moderate block on the Supreme Court of people like Justice Lewis Powell as an excuse for permitting affirmative action light without recognizing the responsibility that we had as a society for systemic and structural racism. And so I thought this was window dressing. I thought it was a Band-Aid. And then as I began my research and I began to appreciate how far back the idea went, how much it was connected to some of the really great thinkers and some of the great advocates of liberty over the last 200 years. And as I started to look at the science of diversity and the strong evidence of the value of diversity, I realized that I had simply been wrong. My skepticism was not justified. And so I've gone from being a skeptic to being a believer.
Speaking of how far back the idea reaches, one of the protagonists in your story is the Supreme Court and some of its most well-known figures. And you write a great deal about Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes and his introduction of the idea of a free marketplace of ideas into America's jurisprudential, but also civic culture of education and free expression.
It's a wonderful story and illustration of diversity in that Holmes was this Boston Brahmin, this member of the upper class, and very much a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And he became very close with two young Jewish law professors, Felix Frankfurter and Harold Lasky, referred to them as my boys. And they, in turn, persuaded him that he had to go back and re-examine the work of John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill and their very important work on liberty, and to think about liberty in terms of freedom of speech and in terms of academic freedom and in terms of the First Amendment allowing and encouraging a marketplace of ideas. And they persuaded him to re-examine all of his views about anti-war speech. Holmes had been a great war hero in the Civil War. He was three times wounded and much decorated. And his reaction to the speech against the First World War was that it was intolerable. And he wrote a number of opinions, including the opinion that sent Eugene Debs to prison. And then, under the influence of Frankfurter and Lasky, he just completely reversed himself and gave us the beginning of what's become our First Amendment doctrine in our country today, or well, at least yesterday.
Not only the prevalent doctrine in the last 120 years or so, but also the expanded doctrine, I think, is where you're taking it, and Oliver Wendell Holmes' role in expanding it, and his reliance on this notion of a free marketplace of ideas. But what I want to ask you about is the insufficiency of the free market of ideas. Your argument about diversity takes us further and introduces the idea not only that we need different ideas, but in fact that we need vying or adversarial ideas as well. And indeed, you mentioned to Jewish law professors and the notion that this idea runs very deep. We learn in the Mishnah, the 2,000-year-old text of rabbinic law, that just as a knife can be sharpened only by the side of another, so too a disciple of a sage improves only through his study partner. And we learned from Thurgood Marshall and Irwin Griswold, in the case that desegregated the University of Texas Law School, that legal education depends entirely upon the thrust and parry of diverse ideas, which cannot exist among a handful of segregated students. So my question to you is this, after hearing these sword play quotes, why is the peaceable marketplace of ideas insufficient? Why do we need ideas to clash?
Well, one, of course, you've answered the question in the way you've asked it, then going back 2,000 years and to the Mishnah. Beyond that, it was initially a question of, I guess, common sense, that the clash of ideas would allow people to see things that they otherwise didn't see and to expand their own horizons. And the Mills argued that that means that you had to have people who came from different groups, from different nations, from different religions, in order to have a meaningful clash of ideas. The science of it is something that we're just starting to appreciate. And what I find really interesting in some of the scientific work is the idea that diversity makes us uncomfortable, and that when we're uncomfortable, we see things we wouldn't otherwise see. That there is in comfort a willingness to just go along with what seems evident instead of to challenge basic assumptions. But it is certainly the case that we've seen this development in the 20th and 21st century of encouraging in education, in business, in science, a clash of ideas in order to generate more ideas, better ideas, ideas that have been more thoroughly examined. And the result has been that diversity really does contribute to better understanding, better learning, better decisions.
Would you be willing to go so far as to argue that opposition to the diversity principle is a symptom of diffidence? More specifically, that insofar as the diversity principle derives from the embrace of a free marketplace of ideas and the clash of ideas, that one should welcome diversity's invitation to make one's argument? Or is it reasonable that one could argue the inverse, namely that the adoption of the diversity principle is merely a concession to cultural relativism and a failure to stand up for one's intellectual inheritance?
I certainly find that I learn from the people I disagree with, and sometimes I change my views because I'm challenged by people who disagree with me. And I think we should all welcome that. Certainly those of us who are in the academy, those of us who teach, should welcome the opportunity to consider views that we hadn't considered, to consider views that we disagree with. And, you know, partly it's to hone the persuasiveness of our own views, but it ought to be more than that. It ought to be to consider that we all can learn and should be engaged in an effort to learn.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
You cite the Supreme Court, and indeed it's really one of the protagonists of the story of diversity, having come around to adopting the diversity principle and more recently reversing themselves. I think those who are proponents of the diversity principle see the Roberts Court as actively and affirmatively searching for vindication against those historic streams of diversity that defined the 20th century. Presumably, proponents of the Roberts Court's positions see the court as courageously willing to reverse generations of jurisprudence that it deems erroneous. Do you see some kind of noble philosophical consistency, or can you see how someone might see that in the Roberts Court's current majority that really feels that the entire diversity principle is an overreach and needed to be pulled back?
Well, sure. I mean, conservatives, putting aside the far right, who have, I think, a different set of goals, I think many conservatives felt that the growing commitment to racial and ethnic diversity, in particular, was offensive to principles of democracy and was not justified by law, by science, and feel vindicated by the Roberts Court and feel that the Roberts Court has ruled correctly and agree with Chief Justice Roberts' professed colorblindness or insistence on legal colorblindness. I think that's that is the conservative view.
You articulate really very compellingly your argument in favor of the diversity principle for many of the reasons we've discussed and many more, with this incredibly rich history and wonderful anecdotes as well. It's really a most engaging and thoroughgoing argument and presentation of this idea in all its complexity and richness. What I want to know from you as we round out the interview is, what surprised you in the course of writing this book?
Oh, well, first I discovered the role of a number of people who either I hadn't heard of at all or I didn't appreciate the importance of their work. And that was a thrill. In particular, Pauli Murray, who was perhaps the most important civil rights lawyer, maybe even the most important lawyer of the 20th century, given the influence that she had on Thurgood Marshall's approach to the cases that led to Brown v. Board of Education and to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's approach to the cases that led to the recognition that the 14th Amendment applied to sex discrimination. And then the unexpected role of Archibald Cox, who it turned out was sort of the ghostwriter for the Powell opinion in the Bakke case.
That established a version of the diversity principle at the federal level. Can you give us a word on that?
Sure. The Bakke case was the case where the Supreme Court ruled by a vote of 4-4-1 that a university could use race as a factor in making admissions decisions if it was part of a broader policy of encouraging diversity in order to gain the benefits of diversity in education. And the argument came from Archibald Cox, the former Watergate prosecutor, only because he'd been fired by President Nixon and had nothing to do. And so he wrote this remarkable brief in a case that was then dismissed as moot, but not before Justice Powell had an opportunity to read it and study it and decide that he liked the argument. And all of that had sort of been lost to history, in part because the brief had been lost, because when Westlaw and Lexis cataloged all of the briefs that had ever been filed in the Supreme Court, they missed it, I think because Harvard submitted two briefs, and I think whoever was cataloging the briefs didn't realize there were two separate briefs, and so they disregarded the brief filed by Cox.
A surprise not just for you, but for history.
Yes, and Cox and I had what I think is called a nodding relationship, which is to say that in my first year at Harvard Law School, we used to have breakfast in the same place. And after a while, when I walked in, he was sitting at his table, I nodded hello. And I wish the younger me would have sat down with him and asked him about that brief, which he had just written the year before. And of course, I would have loved to have told him about how influential it would be in the lives of many, many, many people, including, it turned out, in mine. Can I add one thing?
Please.
I know that, including in my own family, there are many who think of the diversity justification for affirmative action as something that was invented in support of the Jewish quota at Harvard in the 1920s. And one of the things I learned in researching this book was that that's simply not true. Diversity was one of the things that was used by Abbot Lawrence Lowell, the president of Harvard beginning in 1909, and he was the instigator of the Jewish quota, along with the instigator of a purge of gay students. And it was Lowell who banned Black students from the dormitories and the eating halls. There's a lot to dislike about Lowell's history. But the president before Lowell, Charles Eliot, who served as president of Harvard from 1869 to 1909, was a great supporter of diversity and a great supporter of Jewish students and of Jewish Americans. He had lobbied to be succeeded by Louis Brandeis, saying that as a Unitarian, he had hoped that he would be succeeded by a Jew. And when Lowell began his campaigning for a Jewish quota at Harvard, Eliot fought him tooth and nail. So the use of diversity at Harvard and the celebration of diversity at Harvard goes back to the 1870s, well before the adoption of the Jewish quota.
Well, thank you, Professor David Oppenheimer, for joining us on the College Commons podcast. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Josh.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.